Adhanom Ghebreyesus says that it will take time for the world to get back to business as usual. His organization recently announced that it was setting up an independent panel to review its handling of the COVID-19 pandemic and the response by governments. The announcement follows strong criticism by President Donald Trump's administration and the U.S. formal notification that it was withdrawing from the U.N. agency. Tedros also noted that the crisis has also brought opportunity to learn.
We must come together in a global conversation to take these hard-won lessons and turn them into action. COVID-19 has taken so much from us, but it's also giving us an opportunity to break with the past and build back better. I want us to see this as opportunity. It's a crisis, but opportunities are born from crisis.
The Trump administration's decision to withdraw from the WHO was widely criticized by global health experts. Many warn that this is the wrong move at a time when infection rates are continuing to spike in places like Africa, the U.S., and others. One campaign, a global movement working to end extreme poverty and preventable diseases by 2030, said in a statement that withdrawing from the WHO puts the safety of millions of people, especially those in the developing world, at risk. One campaign CEO, Gail Smith, who worked in the previous U.S. administration's Ebola response and as head of USAID, tells me that the U.S. government should provide more funding for a global pandemic response package to help strengthen global health systems while ensuring that there will be equitable access to an eventual COVID-19 vaccine.
I think there's a huge cost to the international community because we need the WHO, again, as a body that helps coordinate, make sure information is coming in and coming out to everybody. It's a provider of assistance that many countries rely on, absolutely. It provides international guidance. And it does things other than the coronavirus. I mean, think about the effort to wipe out polio. There are a number of other things WHO does. So I think the implications are very negative, quite frankly, for the global response, but also for the United States.
During this COVID-19 global pandemic, we know one of the things that have been adversely affected has been the economies, global economies, including here the U.S., in many African countries. We know that a lot of public health programs on the continent depend on funding coming from the U.S., from, you know, other European partner countries. And that they stopped that, given that these countries are already suffering themselves economically, that they're going to reduce some of their foreign aid or the foreign funding that they give to these countries. What are some of the dangers in contracting or in reducing foreign aid, especially to the public health sector?
If you look at the gains of the last 25 years in Africa, both at the macroeconomic level, but particularly in public health, to take money away from that investment to either put it exclusively into the pandemic or to save money at home is to go backwards. And the fact is the international community needs to sustain those investments in public health, as do African and other governments, while at the same time responding to the pandemic. Now, we've had a couple of good signs. The replenishment, the multi-year funding for the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria, and the Global Vaccine Alliance both surpassed their targets, right? So that's a good sign. Mm-hmm. I think the danger is, as you suggest, that because of the economic pressure at home, donors will start to step back. And at one level, you can understand that, but that's a very expensive proposition because part of what the fight for ending this pandemic is about is protecting the progress that's been made over the last couple of decades, and it would be real folly to let that erode.
We've had talk that the pandemic has taught us a lot about ourselves, our countries, our structures, our systems, our institutions. But in terms of global cooperation, at the height of the Ebola crisis, the attitude here in the U.S. was that this is not something that is really going to affect us. We don't really care that much. up until that one case.
It did.
What is it about, I guess, that time, but also this time now that shows that we should learn about, you know, global cooperation, the importance of global cooperation?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I think this is made very clear, as did Ebola, but this is even more stark, that we are absolutely connected globally. So in this case, none of us are going to be safe until all of us are safe. And so there's an imperative to collaborate globally, because no country can exist in isolation from any other. I think that's the first. I think the second, and we've seen this at the global scale and within countries, is a crisis like this hits hardest where there are the fewest coping mechanisms and tools with which to fight back. So we are seeing among the poorest countries in the world much more damage being inflicted than among wealthier nations. And within countries, here in the United States, for example, we're seeing a totally disproportionate impact, not surprisingly, on people of color and the poor. But I think the third lesson to take away from this is we need to invest scientific capital. We need to invest resources, financial capital, but we also need to invest political capital. And on the one hand, I'm finding in a lot of parts of the world there's not enough of that. I do think on the Africa side, the political capital being invested by the African Union, by President Ramaphosa, by the ECA, by a host of organizations in hanging together and fighting back, that's a good thing to watch. It's a source of hope.
Before I go, let's talk about the frustration, because I think I did want to speak on that frustration. There's a lot of frustration going around. As a person who's working in this space,
yeah,
what are some of your frustrations?
My frustration is that we know how to fight back against this, right? I mean, look what happened in West Africa during the Ebola epidemic. Three countries ravaged by decades of war, supported by a lot of countries, but nonetheless, they pushed back and defeated an Ebola epidemic. So certainly the world can defeat this pandemic, but I think there's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of discounting of science and scientific fact. There's more competition for things like PPE and medical supplies than there is collaboration to make sure that enough gets to everybody quickly enough. So I guess my frustration is that this is a big, costly problem for the whole world. We know how to solve it. We're not focused on solving it the way we should be. So we're extending the life of the pandemic, and I think the suffering for everyone is affected.
That was One Campaign CEO Gail Smith. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Welcome back. You're listening to Upfront on The Voice of America. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Now, even as the world continues to grapple with the COVID-19 pandemic, many cities, especially here in the U.S., saw widespread protests against police brutality and systemic racism, especially after the death of George Floyd at the hands of police. The marches inspired similar protests around the world. In Europe, the protesters called for countries like Belgium and Britain to reckon with their colonial past. Last week on the show, we spoke to Adam Hochschild, author of the critically acclaimed book, King Leopold's Ghost. If you missed that show, check it out on our page at voanews.com. The marches also inspired protests in some African cities like Nairobi, where Kenyans are also raising the issue of police brutality. Kenya's Human Rights Watch says that 25 Kenyans have died due to police brutality in the last 3 months alone. So far, only one police officer has been charged after killing a 13-year-old boy while enforcing COVID lockdowns in Nairobi. As Marino Jambo reports from Nairobi, activists and rights groups say that one of the main reasons why security officers are not held accountable has to do with the fact that most of the killings take place in poor neighborhoods.
Kenyan government officials and police officers have been threatening activists and human rights groups trying to get justice for police killings and abuses arising during the curfew hours in the country. And this was evident on 7th of this month when human rights activists were arrested while protesting against the government over police killings. Njoki Gashanja is an activist based in Githurai slums in Nairobi. She said, most of the killings in the area have been as a result of police brutality while imposing dusk to dawn curfew. She says the most affected are the poor and that currently those who are protesting on 7th are receiving threats from the police.
The people who are experiencing this violence firsthand are the poor. Because anytime you're talking about police violence, police brutality, police extortion, it's usually in the informal settlements, it's usually in the ghettos. It's a reality that we live with every single day. So what we experienced during the Saba Saba March for Our Lives is actually the true picture of what we go through every single day in our ghettos. But now that we have come back to our homes, no one is reporting on the aftermath. Very many comrades after the march received direct threats from police officers.
Most human rights activists received threats of arrest and even warned not to post any information about police brutality on social media. Most of them are raided both at home and at workplace and their equipment confiscated. Njoki said that the dialogues they have held with the Kenya's top security officials have not been successful as most of the police officers accused of brutal actions are still on duty.
Just the other day last month, we held a meeting, the CS Interior. We were with the IG. We were with the police spokesman. And these are cases that they know. They know that the police on the ground are actually brutalizing us. They know that they are abusing us. But these cases don't see the light of day. You will find this police officer 3 months down the line still outside, you know, maybe on bail or just came out on very fishy grounds. I will give you a very good example. We've complained for a very long time about the killer cop Rashid from Madare, Isili, Pangani, and just today we saw the headlines that he's been transferred to Kayole. The question is, why would you transfer a killer cop?
Judy Simiyu lost her brother in Huruma slums after he was shot by police officers in May this year while on patrol. She says the police interfered with all the evidence and even after launching a complaint at the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, nothing has been done so far.
The police came and he didn't know they were police officers since they were not in uniform. So when they removed the handcuff is when he realized he was arguing with the police. They beat him up and then handcuffed him. They directed him to walk ahead of them, and then they shot him. The police took him to the mortuary. Then, following day, the police came and washed the scene where he was killed at to prevent us from getting the evidence. We are still following up the case, and we haven't gotten justice.
Amnesty International Kenya welcomes the public declaration by the executive that there will be zero tolerance for violent police officers moving forward and that individual officers will be held personally liable. Faith Kasina is a coordinator at Kayole Slum Community Justice Center, born and brought up in Kayole. Many of her friends have been killed by police officers. Kayole is notoriously known in Nairobi for insecurity and robbery with violence among the young people, this leading to most of them shot by police almost on a daily basis. She says Most of her friends have been picked from house or even place of work and killed with no reason.
I can tell stories of people whom we've grown up together. They're normal, you know. I've had friends who are just picked at their place of work and police killed them. We've also had stories of people who are taken from their houses by police and they're killed. And these are scenarios that you watch every day. There are a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old were taken out of their house by the police, called the mob justice, and killed them in front of their father. Those are the kind of injustices that we deal with.
Kasina says it's very difficult to find justice for the victim since police officers are threatening human rights groups trying to defend the rights of the people.
My stories with extrajudicial killings, being that I also document these cases, I deal with these families. It's so sad that even our families cannot get justice. You've documented a case, you've referred to IPOA, but the same officer keeps killing people. Sometimes families come out just to document, you know, not because they're sure their family, their kin will get justice, but because they don't want another child to go through the same pain, but they never get justice.
The Human Rights Watch says since the dusk to dawn curfew was imposed in March as one of the measures to contain the spread of COVID-19 pandemic, at least 25 civilians have been killed by the Kenya police. A senior researcher at the Kenya's Human Rights Watch, Otieno Namwaya, said that the current regime does not respect human rights and that most victims may not get justice.
Consider that since corona started, the corona-related killings by police are currently at around 25, together with a cluster of CSOs working on police killings. I think there should still be hope. However, I don't think that justice is likely to happen under the current regime. I do think that the current regime is hostile generally to human rights and justice issues. So the cases that are likely to be prosecuted and the families that are likely to get justice are going to be basically cherry-picked, depending on which one is a low-hanging fruit for the police or the IPOA that can be prosecuted without any political risks.
Namwaya, however, blames the independent body mandated to prosecute officers going against the rule of law, the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, for siding with the government and hence making it difficult for victims to get justice.
We have gotten to a point where we feel IPOA hasn't been doing enough. IPOA has picked only cases that are less sensitive for prosecution or cases where there is public outcry. So the success rate of IPOA is wanting, but I also know that there is political interference. So IPOA, as it stands today, cannot touch the politically sensitive cases. So we have had issues with IPOA for the last 2-3 years where we feel IPOA is being used to whitewash the police.
Kenyans have been demonstrating for justice over police brutality with no success as individual officers committing crime go scot-free. Reporting for VOA's Upfront, I am Moreno Jambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Upfront on the Voice of America. My name is Jackson Bungani. Now, as cities across the continent begin to gradually reopen their economies, authorities are asking people to wear masks in public. In some cases, people are taking the warning seriously, and in other cases, many are still on the fence about this issue. Here is what some of you are saying about these new regulations.
Of course, telling us they're okay, they're protecting us, but not like we don't put them all full time like it's we intend. It's not easy, you know. But we believe they'll help us with time, and we know we shall drop to them putting them on.
Yeah, the mask to me, it is the way that I can protect myself and my brothers, because if the saliva has come out of me, it will affect this person if I happen to be having coronavirus. But if I'm putting on a mask, there's no way that the spit or the saliva should go and spread my surroundings. We need to protect ourselves and we protect our surrounding, which are the colleagues, the friends, the family members. You should leave the mask, unless when you are in your room, in your actually inside your house, that's where you should leave the mask.
Yeah, putting mask, to me, the way I understand it, it does not control the disease. Though you have it or not, it's still depending on where you meet with people. But putting mask, it's okay, it can protect, but that's not perfect. That's the way I understand it.
I'm not putting on a mask because some of us, we have our own problems. Like me, for me, I have asthma. If I put on a mask, I feel uncomfortable, seriously. I feel like when I'm not breathing well, so that's why I don't put it on. Yeah, only God is the one to protect me.
This is Upfront on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C. You just heard some voices of residents in towns and cities across Africa, people expressing their opinions on some of the new regulations during the COVID pandemic, especially the requirement to wear masks in public to avoid infection. Now, there's consensus that masks work, and in fact, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the coronavirus outbreak surging across the nation could be controlled if people are disciplined about wearing masks. But as the world continues in its fight against COVID-19, in the U.S., the country continues to grapple with the pandemic, but it's also dealing with a sustained movement of outrage over systemic racism and police brutality. This issue resonates with the thousands of African immigrants who live in the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C., and they recently held a march of solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. And one of the people who spoke at that rally is Tambra Ray Stevenson, the founder of Native Soul Kitchen. Her organization is leading a new initiative called WANDA, Women Advancing Nutrition, Dietetics, and Agriculture, to empower women and girls to lead and create healthy communities in Africa and the diaspora. She joins me via phone.
So Tambra, why is it important to you that African immigrants in America add their voices to this movement?
Well, number one, we're a global Black community, and just separated between the Atlantic Ocean and other water bodies or ships that dropped off diasporans in different locations across the Western Hemisphere. And so with that said, we recognize that the U.S. has been constructed, you know, based on political and economic power. And there's unity in numbers. And so the more divisiveness, which is an old colonial tactic that happens in separating people, is used and deployed in communities, we will continue to see that we're not, that's part of the plan. And so the goal for us is to understand old colonial tactics that are still being used in modern day era and understand that the strength is in unity. And so when African immigrants find themselves in America and deciding on who should they have allegiance or alliance with, it should be people who are Black people. It really is that simple. We make it difficult because that's how propaganda is spread to create that division. But dividing rule is throughout tribes, and it's throughout the country. And it's one that we should know our history to understand that. Or otherwise, just like Sankofa tradition, we are doomed to repeat it again.
Mm. Now, as an African American, what is the importance of connecting to your African roots? Is that something that you are encouraged to do, whether it is at home, growing up, or in schools? What kind of exposure to African history do you get as part of your education?
Number one, for me, African history is not found in most U.S. educational classrooms. That's not part of the goal. If the colonial attack is division, then also erasure of knowledge and history is a part of that tool tactic as well. So for me, I've had the benefit of being raised in an African immigrant, African American household. So experience is the first form of education for me. And from there, it took time and understanding and my own personal growth and self-mastery to understand that identity is crucial. And if that identity, when it comes to Black in America, is only affiliated with slavery, then I wanted to reclaim and redefine what my identity was. And so finding my heritage, you know, back to Nigeria, Niger, the Hausa land to the Fulanis was crucial for me to recognize that one, my heritage and meaning in life is much deeper. There's a deep culture and rich history and tradition and language that I can be proud of, just like anyone else is proud of their culture. And then at the same time, it creates that unity, again, part of the strategy of separation, that there are millions of people out there that have DNA running through their veins as mine, and that blood brings us together. And now it's time for us to create our own educational systems and structures, which we do are working on through WANDA and developing our own academy, how to leverage digital spaces that are decolonized, that we can learn and teach a Pan-African approach to food through women as a means to create the healing and peace that our communities so deserve.
Mm-hmm. And as a food entrepreneur, what role does food play in this process of reconnection or education?
Yeah, food is powerful. One, because food represents identity. It represents culture. It represents community. And therefore, it creates a sense of belonging when we break fufu or bread together. And again, that's why even in my study of nutrition in school, we had a course in food and culture on African foods, but it was very limiting. And it's more than what most people get. So for me, it was an opportunity to understand that the food is an opportunity to have that conversation around how do we bring our communities together and how do we have a seat at the table that's unified. And therefore, we have an opportunity to expand the conversation that we are one global Black community.
Okay. When you talk about decolonizing food, what do you mean?
Well, number one, it's from a history and a nutrition standpoint. When we think about all things that are not natural, such as the processing of sugar, the concept of just corn syrup in our food, processed food products, or we think about refined white flour products, all those, as well as, you know, even the over-processed milk, it follows a central dogma. And to understand that is crucial in understanding that if you're not down with colonialism, then you're not down with colonized foods. And so to decolonize that are foods that I call rich in color and variety, that are ancestral, that you're, so in my opinion, and my understanding for me, part of the Fulani diet is millet is crucial. Yes, they did have milk, but it was not, for Denono, it was not processed in the same way in which we have milk products today. And so the less processed the food, the close to nature that it is, regardless what it is, we understand that strong people eat strong food, and that's food of your ancestors. And that's part of the decolonizing process. But it takes an emancipation of the mind even to get to the point of decolonizing the food. And sometimes it can work vice versa, because food is like a light switch. It can turn off your genes, and it can turn on a new way of thinking just by the process of being at the table and eating together.
That was Tambra Ray Stevenson, the founder of Native Soul Kitchen, based here in the Washington, D.C. area. And with that, we come to the end of our show today. I want to thank you for tuning in, and I want to thank all our guests and all of you who sent in your opinions on the issue of wearing masks in public. If you missed our last show, check it out at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on our social media platforms. We are on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. Don't forget to like and subscribe to our channel. Until next time, my name is Jackson Vunganyi. Goodbye, Africa.